Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm Penny Eiler, a member of the program committee. Prairie aspires to be an open-hearted and open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, or family structure. We welcome you no matter what your age or your abilities or inabilities. Later in the service, we will invite visitors and guests and returning friends to introduce yourselves so that we might get to know you better. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services. They are presented either by a Prairie member, a member of the wider community, or by our minister, Sandy Ingham. Today, Ryan Erstman from the Farmers Veterans Coalition will be doing our presentation. For our opening words, I'd like to invite up Rachel Long.
They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation. Neither shall they learn war anymore. Isaiah 2:4.
Please welcome the Gervais family to light the chalice this morning.
That's weird.
Someone likes the story.
In honor of those we have known and loved in the past, in recognition of the gifts and sacrifices they have made on our behalf, and in our sincere hopes that we may be worthy of their memory, we light our candles, we give our thanks, and we offer our prayers. Amen. Charles F. Clay.
Today, Ryan Erstman will be presenting. Ryan grew up on an organic grain and livestock farm in Parma, Illinois. He graduated from UW-Madison in 1997 and was commissioned as a Marine Corps second lieutenant. An infantry officer by training, Ryan served in various billets that culminated with two tours in Iraq, the second as the commander of a 170-man rifle company. Ryan left after active duty after promotion to major in 2007. His forthcoming book, No Better Friend, details his rifle company's experience with the Al-Anbar Awakening, where Marines partnered with Iraqi tribes and pacified a region together. Ryan, with his wife Sarah and their twin two-year-olds, Hazel and Cardiston, are looking to establish their own farm outside of Madison. So if you know of any farms available, welcome, Ryan.
Thank you, first of all, for the honor of speaking to you today. Because it's Memorial Day weekend, I feel compelled to acknowledge the occasion as a time to mourn. I grew up attending St. Mary's Catholic Church in the tiny farming community of Assumption, Illinois. And as a kid, I remember marveling at how many men in the congregation wore VFW uniforms on Memorial Day. When they read the roster of the town's war dead at the cemetery service, I recognized some of the last names, but they weren't people I'd known. Memorial Day means different things to different people, and certainly for veterans. For me, after two tours in Iraq, remembrance is no longer a dutifully honored moment of silence on a specific day. Remembrance comes as randomly as rain. It is a roster of colleagues, friends, and brothers in arms. It is ambushes and firefights. It is medical evacuations. It is kick-in-the-gut messages flatly delivered. Died of wounds. It's condolence letters and phone calls to next of kin and memorial services where the tiny tink-tink of dog tags being hung on the inverted rifle fills a room with a hammering finality. But mourning is only part of the day. At noon on Memorial Day, we raise the flag from half-mast to its full height as a symbol of resolve. It is a time to heal. There are numerous ways for veterans to heal and resume their lives after serving in the military. And many continue to serve in new ways. In 2008, Michael O'Gorman, an organic vegetable farmer in California, founded the Farmer Veteran Coalition in order to mobilize veterans to help feed America. The Farmer Veteran Coalition arrived at a time when we stand at the crossroads of two converging trends in America. The average American farmer is 58 years old, and two people retire from farming for every one who enters, leaving our agricultural communities in critical need. At the same time, while unemployment remains high, it is consistently higher for our nation's 2.4 million post-9/11 veterans. But there's a green lining to all this. Some of those who once answered the nation's call to serve on the battlefield are discovering the calling to serve in the farm fields. After the crucible of combat and life and death decision making, few endeavors satisfy the need for intellectual and physical challenges and a sense of purpose as raising food to feed one's family and community. Veterans successfully transition to farming because they know how to deal with adversity. They understand problem solving, and perhaps knowing firsthand the fragility of life, they embrace the responsibility of nurturing crops and animals with great passion. Many promising seeds of our community's agricultural future lies in our current crop of veterans. It is time to plant. The Farmer Veteran Coalition helps recent veterans transition into farming through educational retreats and workshops. In Wisconsin, that's included Growing Power in Milwaukee, the Michael Fields Institute in Burlington, and the Moses Organic Conference in La Crosse. Farmer Veteran Coalition also helps veterans through fellowship grants that allow veterans to purchase needed equipment for their farm, through mentoring programs that partner veterans with experienced farmers, and through the AgriBility program that helps disabled veterans modify their buildings and equipment to meet their accessibility needs. Our farmer veterans come from diverse backgrounds and own and operate a variety of farms. The Farmer Veteran Coalition does not endorse one type of farming over another. We honor the veteran's choice to farm as he or she chooses. So what's all this have to do with you? It is a time to build, and it takes real people to build a community. Facebook and LinkedIn can help us assemble enormous virtual networks, but they cannot trump the bond of real human interaction, the connection and trust conveyed through eye contact and honest word of mouth. Take our message back to your communities. Many of those retiring or transitioning farmers are right here in Wisconsin, and so are many recent veterans. Through your friends or the friends of your friends and family members, we may find the next veteran interested in farming, or the next farmer or landowner interested in partnering with a veteran. When we help people make these connections, we help build stronger communities together. communities that will feed themselves and thus feed America. Thank you. I actually have cards and brochures if anybody's so interested. So the question, is it hard to find a farm? It's hard to find a farm that's affordable. And one of the problems that you can say really within the last 30 years is as we have moved away from being an agricultural nation and fewer people farm, fewer people are connected to land as what it means to produce for us. And as we've urbanized, and there's nothing wrong with that, the value of land has increased, disconnected from its ability to produce, because we value it more for a place to retreat from the urban life. And so what you end up with is land being priced out of realistic production value. And especially in the green belts that once fed our cities, those keep moving farther and farther away from the cities. And really the more interesting or fun a city is to live in, like Madison, like Portland, like Seattle, some other places that I've lived, the more difficult it is to find farmland near there. Are there farms available? Yes. Are they necessarily affordable? That becomes more challenging. And that's not that's all beginning farmers. That's the challenge of getting into farming for everybody. We're essentially a networking organization, and we work with a variety of other organizations, whether it's financial institutions. In Wisconsin, we do have a relationship with Badgerland Financial because they understand the issue, Farm Service Agency. So all the same organizations that are out there that would help a beginning farmer, we can also show a veteran, this is the way, this is how you would go about purchasing land. The biggest connection becomes finding land that's, again, available. And what we found in other places, we haven't done it yet in Wisconsin, is that there are people who would be interested in transitioning or renting their farm out, but a lot of them are holding on because they don't have another generation in their own family to take it over, and they don't want somebody to come in there and knock down all the buildings, take out the trees, and farm it from edge to edge as if we're still stuck in the 1970s with our old butts. So, yeah, some of you know who I'm talking about. So, in some cases, and I know of a couple specific stories, one out of Illinois, there was a farmer, 90 years old, still living on his land, and his daughters in their 60s called the Land Connection in Bloomington, Illinois, and say, do you have somebody, and they're an incubator farm, who would be interested in renting ground and living in the second house on the same property? And they found an Afghanistan vet.
Oh.
And so you had an Afghanistan vet and his wife working with a World War II veteran. And what happened eventually is because the young veteran and his wife were running small livestock and sheep, the owner realized there hadn't been sheep and small livestock on the farm since something like the late 40s. And he gave them the rest of the lease for free just to put animals back on the land. And those are some of the connections we hope to be able to make across generations with that common bond of background and interest in the future. All situations are applicable. There's both my personal, thank you. In my own personal background, I grew up on a farm. I grew up around livestock. I'm very comfortable with that. Now, I sit in a very awkward situation, or not awkward, but just a unique background. People think organic farm, they're like, oh, small vegetable operation, you know, your parents were hippies. No, it's a 2,300 acre grain and livestock operation.
Oh, wow.
That at the time in Illinois when my dad started farming in 63 at 1,800 acres, that was huge. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We were one of the big ones. Now, our neighbors are 9,000, 10,000, 4,000, 6,000.
Oh my God.
We're the little guy. Almost no one has livestock. We still run a fairly large herd because for us that is part of the natural rotation.
Sure.
Is to, when you put land fallow, it really makes more sense to put animals on it. Mm-hmm. Because you have a natural process of mowing and fertilization that goes on there.
Exactly.
And utilization. So with the Farmer Veteran Coalition in general, when I say all types of farming, all types of farms, those who come from a background where they're going to return to the family farm and it's a large conventional operation, that's fine, and that works out very well. If you're not inheriting or walking into a turnkey operation, then most people that start in farming, veterans or not, the only way you can start is with small acreage because it's the only thing you can afford to do.
Mm-hmm.
And when we talk about sustainable business models and systems and affordability regarding the prices of land, then you have to be able to get on very little with what you have in acreage. Me personally, my wife and I leased a farm for 18 months outside of Watertown before she came to work in Madison. And on 7 acres with some cattle, hogs, chickens, and our own crops and tillage, there's no tractor. I did everything with a walk-behind machine.
Oh, wow.
So, and I just integrate that. I did less running, and that was my fitness.
Free.
So,
free.
Yeah, free. And I can tell you that I literally burned 5 gallons of diesel for an entire summer through that thing. So,
wow.
Fairly efficient. Now, is that for all people? No. Probably not. But it worked for me. You have me specifically, what would I like? Probably more than I can afford. But yeah, for small livestock, I think 15 to 20 acres is a realistic start, and then you try to grow from there. And that's one of the concerns, is you don't want to have, you can have a very nice, interesting small place, but suddenly be surrounded by development where there is no room to build a bigger system. We have had interest from the White House.
Oh, good.
Okay. Specifically, we have partnerships with the USDA and the Farm Bureau at the national level. But what's been interesting, and that's, I am the first, my title is ambassador to the Midwest region, which I find awkward, but a board decided on that, and so it shall be. But we didn't have, other than our veterans that are actually out there farming, we didn't have people in the communities spreading the word. And just because you have national leadership saying this is what we should do, doesn't mean that we're actually doing anything about it. And so 2 weeks ago, I was actually in the FSA office in Madison and talking to the chief of loans. And he's like, yeah, we know about you guys, but I went upstairs to the NRCS office and literally nobody in the room had heard of us.
What's NRCS?
Natural Resource Conservation Development, part of the USDA. So, but those are the extension agents. So it's one of the, when I talk about building community and word of mouth, that you can have a virtual presence, but until everybody knows that, and it's a friend of a friend saying, hey, here's a program out here and here's what we need to be doing, all the support in the world from above can get you some grants and some money, but it takes us to make it happen. So again, at national level, the USDA understands the importance of all those programs. And I guess the sad thing, and this is me speaking personally, is that we have to have a lot of these programs in place because otherwise it's very difficult to make a living at farming. And so we, to some extent, subsidize our own environmentalism so we can afford to be out there on the land taking care of it and not draining it of every single resource it can give us for that period of time. So we're very much in favor of that. But I think long term, real sustainability that's long term means that we don't need to subsidize our environmentalism, and we should be able to build systems that also pay for themselves. That's a challenge. Now, I can tell you that my parents' farm has paid for itself. Unsubsidized, no grants, no government programs, through the farm crisis of the 1980s. And the only reason my dad waited until 1990 to convert to organic was that was when he was finally out of debt, because nobody was going to give him an operating loan to go organic at 2,000 acres in one shot. So once he got out of debt, he said, okay, now we do it my way. And so it's Yeah, and there's no book, there's no speaker, there's nothing else. You can find the farm on the internet. And that has in some ways become my goal. Where else can we do this? Where else can we do the right thing on our own and make a fair living doing it? Now that's not FVC, that's me. But that's where I want to go with it. We have an excellent relationship with Growing Power in Milwaukee. And if you want to talk about urban farming, I think at the individual level, the model of urban farming is Robert Frost, not the poet, but the guy who's still living in Johnson Creek and about to move to Minneapolis. If you don't know who that is, One Straw Rob is the website, and it is eye-opening. I think the future, the opportunities are there for everybody to produce more of your own food, to make a system that works for all of us. And Growing Power is probably the largest organizational system that I know of that's doing that and doing it very well. And we actually have a handful of veterans that work through Growing, and that's not something where we pushed veterans in there. We made a partnership with Growing Power, and the veterans were already in the system because it was a good system, it works, they're doing a lot in downtown Milwaukee. So the Farmer Veteran Coalition believes in helping the whole person. And to that end, much of it is education with the retreats, the workshops, sponsoring veterans. I think we had 13 vets go to the Moses Organic Conference last year from the Midwest. We had another 11 or 12 this year, and then you run into other people there. That's a lot of what the Farmer Veteran Coalition does, is setting up the education, networking with other incubator farms and organizations. There are several veteran-run incubator farms popping up throughout the country. We do not see them as competition. We see them as allies in one large mission that we need to accomplish. So a lot of what we do is education, training, and again, part of it is that trying to find those partnerships with mentors so that we can pair an interested veteran up with somebody who has that experience and say, this is what I recommend, this is what I would do, or, you know, don't try that, I've been there and failed. And that's at least 50% of farming. So very much so, that's something important to us. And that's not just veterans, that's beginning farming in general. We are seeing, I would call it an echo boom from the back to the land movement of the 1970s. I think we're seeing that again. I have been impressed going to the Beginning Livestock and Dairy Farmers class, which is taught by Dick Cates at the University of Wisconsin. It's a winter short course. And I surveyed the room, and in 28 students in the class, there were only two that had grown up on farms.
Wow.
But everybody has that, welcome to Wisconsin, everybody has that one or two generations removed. My grandparents farmed, or my uncle, you know, my parents didn't grow up on the farm, but I was still connected to it, or I worked there in the summer. So everybody has that heartfelt, this is still where I need to be, or I want to go back. And that was also kind of throughout the room. So I think that's happening across the country with people, you know, 30, 40, younger. So incubator farm is a farm in which you bring in interns, young people, beginning farmers, and essentially they work there for a period of time. They're taking classes, they're learning financial management, business systems, and working out in the field, and they're learning. So that incubator is essentially preparing them to go off and start to run their own farms. And these are very common, both we see them run by veterans, which addresses your whole thing of the whole veteran, and what do we do for that? We find that the Farmer Veteran Coalition ends up being an unofficial network of just getting together with other people who have some commonality of background in addition to their current interest in farming makes a difference. And just knowing that there are other people out there that you can use the terminology and say, well, where were you? Who were you deployed with? What'd you do? And another guy's like, okay. You build that bond of trust that's just there. I think farmers and veterans in some ways both end up being geographically and somewhat psychologically isolated in their lives. And so we also try to address that by being a network of common experience. so far, we're mainly addressing veterans. So those who have been out of school, have served. Most of our veterans are of post 9/11, so have served somewhere after September 11th, 2001. We do have older veterans that are part of the organization, as long as they're essentially beginning farmers. We call them U-turners, people who have another business, retire, and then later in life have the capital to buy a farm and go into farming. I'm working, there's a guy up in Ashland right now, Toby Griggs, who has the Griggs Cattle Company. He's a retired pilot who started flying A4s in Vietnam. Finally retired and bought his farm, 130 acres, in 2010. So he's a beginning farmer, technically. Everybody fights their own war. In my book project, I can tell you it's amazing that you can have three guys that were right next to each other in the same gunfight and get three completely different stories. And our entire wiring, our whole process of how we were raised, what we expected, comes to bear when you experience a traumatic event and how you process that. So everybody processes those things differently. I know from some friends, I can tell you personally, I had no intention of going back to farming. When I left the Marine Corps, I was going to coach cross country, teach history, and be quite happy with that. And there was a period of nothing else seemed satisfying. And literally, of all things, on my knees underneath a combine, so this isn't, you know, nice pastoral taking care of the calves and stuff. This is bloody fingers, bean stubble, because you're organic and you have a lot of green stuff that goes through and suddenly you slug a large machine, digging grass and roots and green stuff out of a combine with your arms overhead for half an hour. And a guy that works for my dad came over and he was like, hey, you missing the Marine Corps now? And I had, you know, I sat there and I was like, you know what? No. And even as a miserable, mindless task like that, I felt this is the important thing I need to be doing. And this is where I belong. And I think a lot of veterans reach that point that, or in something else, but you find that thing that says, this is me. And this is what I should be doing. And farming sort of came back to me in that way, that, okay, maybe not where I grew up, but this is where I need to be. There are a lot of organizations that would love to hire vets. And that's across the board. That's General Electric, that's Home Depot, that's, you know, locally Badgerland Financial. I mean, it's out there. There's seems to be two versions. Is one that all recent veterans are suffering from PTSD and untrainable, and the other version is that everyone's a hero and ready to go into the job force with these unbelievable leadership and skill sets. It is both and it is neither. And I can tell you from my own guys, I have several Marines that are now out of the Marine Corps, used their GI Bill, went to school, and one of my top squad leaders, who was only 20 at the time, finished his degree at Temple University in December and went for Lincoln Financial was the company, and a two-year leadership intern program that was highly competitive against several Ivy League schools. And he's like, hey, I probably didn't get it, but I threw my hat in the ring. They gave him the job. And, you know, because he was 27. He's older, and he had significant leadership experience, and he's one of those guys that he's very engaging, very bright-eyed, and has three combat tours under his belt. But he's one of those people that also, as a squad leader, was reaching out to the Iraqis, figured out, you know, the shot you don't fire may be the most powerful thing that you do. And that understanding of people and that level of leadership and experience, people took notice. Okay. Two loaded questions. Here we go. A minute to spare. fairly personal story. My brother and I went to a boarding school. And that was because the educational system, to my dad's standards in central Illinois, did not measure up to what he wanted. My dad had gone to a boarding school in Prairie du Chien, Campion. That's been an industrial park for years, but Campion was there at one time. So I accepted that as normal, but I think part of that was, you know, my brother and I left the farm fairly early and looked to the greater world as, you know, we would settle someplace else. So, yeah, leaving for the most part at 14, and then after going to boarding school in St. Louis, I didn't want to go to college in Illinois closer than I'd gone to high school. So I came to Wisconsin. And then after that, served 10 years in the Marine Corps, lived on both coasts, went overseas several times. So, yeah, I think my dad understands that it's very hard for me to come home. Probably in the same respect that the Greek philosopher Heraclitus, I think, was, said that no man ever steps in the same river twice, because he's not the same man and it's not the same river. And I find that applies to going home. It's not the same place and I'm not the same person. And so for me, my culture, my style fits better here. And I have that need to go build my own thing. That presents some significant multi-generational conundrums. Because we still want to maintain the farm for what it is. Short description of the book. Most people understand that the Iraq turnaround happened in 2007 with what they call the Al-Anbar Awakening, which was the rising of the tribes. A lot still equates success, or at least the turnaround in the war, to this sudden surge of 30,000 troops. And that's some of it, but that wasn't the answer where I served between Fallujah and Ramadi, because we didn't get those troops. And that was the most violent province in Al-Anbar. And that also saw the greatest security gains in that time period. And so it wasn't about numbers, it was about quality trumping quantity, and a few good men and women going out there, figuring out real counterinsurgency, understanding or trying to understand the Iraqi culture and identifying with the people specifically, and really not, you know, decisions made from on high, but those young corporals like Matt Neary, who I mentioned, becoming what we once called strategic corporals, realizing that the decisions they made could end up on the 6 o'clock news if they were wrong. And understanding the larger picture with respect to us and the Iraqis, building relationships, reacting to violent situations with the least amount of violence that they could, when they could, and mostly focusing on that partnership. And realizing that it was only through working with them together that we were going to achieve success. And so much of the book, No Better Friend, which is Sulla's epitaph, No Better Friend, No Worse Enemy, became the Marine Corps' motto in the invasion of Iraq. And General Mattis said, make sure everybody understands that in the United States Marines, they will see no better friend, no worse enemy. And there have been a couple books written, No Worse Enemy. You know, it's just, you don't screw with us or you pay for it. But I think the other side of the coin is probably just as interesting, that in partnership, we made a lot of things happen. And it wasn't coming down from a large scale. This was platoon commanders and squad leaders, guys in their early 20s, who understood a strategic picture, made decisions out there patrolling, and took my basic guidance without me being behind them, telling them what to do, and made things happen. And it reflects the Iraqis as well. They have a different moral code than we do. We tried to enforce very strict, you know, smuggling is illegal and that's illegal. Well, hey, it's a different world over there. The guys I partnered with were involved in all kinds of, you know, smuggling, other business schemes. If you give them money for a contract, there was constant skimming and graft, and that was normal. And so we had to take off the Boy Scout goggles and say, okay, we can't enforce our code on them. We have to understand how their culture functions. We're not going to get a better ally than the one we have. This is our friend. Short synopsis of what I hope to achieve in the book. I have become quite disillusioned with the entire system of publishing. Just actually, this is in a totally different realm. Spoke to a couple authors yesterday who do woodworking, very different animal, but they own their own printing company. And essentially explained to me the system, how they worked it, what their profit was on an individual book, and how they saved. And they're like, yeah, it's the large publishing companies will essentially make you do all the work, and they'll take the money. So I have, to some extent, strayed away from going through a large-scale publishing system and getting an agent and all that, and I'm now much more interested in small-scale self-publishing, at least at the beginning.
Thank you so much. I'm glad we had lots of time for questions because they had some good ones. For our closing words are from Maya Angelou. How important it is for us to recognize and celebrate our heroes and sheroes. So it's almost time to raise the flag to the full staff and go out there and enjoy these freedoms and liberties that all these veterans had enabled us to enjoy. So turn and greet your neighbor. Have a wonderful day. Thank you.